Mexico is ripe for revolution. But you wouldn't know about it, judging from what you see and hear on the establishment press. Only perhaps if you read articles and a book by Dick Rivas, or perhaps Philip Russell's book about Mexico, would you be aware of this. This is the subject tonight on our Alternative Views news magazine.
Good evening. Welcome to Alternative Views. Tonight we are having an in-depth focus on Mexico, and we're going to devote our entire program to this topic. Our guests are longtime Austin residents, political activists, and authors Philip Russell and Dick Rivas. Phil is the author of a book, Mexico in Transition, that discusses the history, the political economy, and the current social-cultural situation in Mexico. And Phil will discuss his book with us tonight and show us some slides of his many trips to Mexico. Dick Rivas has published a book, Without Documents, on the undocumented immigrant workers here, and has also written some fascinating articles, which you may have read in the Texas Monthly. Dick, welcome to Alternative Views. Phil, I might just note in advance that you may think that Dick got his cast fighting with the Mexican guerrillas up in the mountains, but unfortunately it's not quite that exciting and romantic. He had a motorcycle accident in Mexico, in Austin, and we're very glad to see that he's now recovering and can be on our show. Well, Dick, we've been seeing on television recently these exciting images of these striking and these struggling Mexicans who are very upset about the fact that the police in El Paso, Texas, have arrested over 200 Mexican workers and shipped them across the border. To retaliate, the Mexicans have several times in the last few days closed the border, not letting American tourists, business people, etc., across. This shows that there's a very heavy, hot political issue about these migrant workers. However, there's no real discussion or explanation of what's really going on in the mass media, particularly television. You've written a book on this topic. Can you shed a little light on the issue over immigrant workers? What's the situation?
You know, the situation is one in which there are hundreds of thousands, millions of jobless workers in Mexico, and they're coming here as they have since at least the 40s or the 30s. And finding jobs. From time to time, the immigration service or the labor unions in this country make an issue of their presence, and there are big deportations. What happened in El Paso this week was that the INS picked up lots of maids whose mothers and grandmothers may have worked in El Paso at the exact same jobs. Why the INS picked El Paso at that time, I don't know.
Isn't there a contradiction here? On one hand, the immigration service plays a very repressive role, arresting and harassing immigrant workers. But on the other hand, they turn their back. They allow it to go on. And indeed, isn't it the case that significant economic forces with agribusiness and the factories are very happy to have a cheap labor supply? How do you explain this contradiction?
Well, it seems to me that the role of the INS in practice is not that of shutting the border, it's that of controlling admissions, so that sometimes they're going to want to let people in, and at other times they're going to want to tighten the flow. There are lots of cases, especially in agriculture, where they have brazenly turn their backs and let people come to harvest a crop. So immigrant Mexican labor is used, it's adjusted according to the labor needs of this country.
Dick, what are the economic pressures in Mexico forcing these people to come northward? And the unemployment rate, which is also a part of it.
The unemployment rate is between 11 and 56%, depending on who you believe. It's probably very close. Philip may know better than I do. I'm going to guess it's close to 40% if you count underemployment. There's been tremendous inflation in Mexico since about 1970, and this is eroding people's wages.
And the currency was devalued also, wasn't it?
Well, this was a part of that move, right?
Well, doesn't this provide a superb labor force for the industries and farms along the border? What are the advantages to the agribusiness and industry people there of having these undocumented workers?
There are all sorts of advantages. First is that they're not going to demand the wages which American workers would demand. They're not going to organize into unions as readily as American workers would. Because of their illegal status, they're not going to organize. And perhaps in the long run, the big advantage is that you don't have to have retirement programs for them. It's labor that you bring in and send out. It's disposable. Another advantage which immigrant labor has had is that it's younger, and that you don't wind up supporting men who have a lot of families in this country. You get a young man, many times an unmarried man, at the prime of his physical capacity, and you get him cheap. A lot of people think that big business is opposed to Mexican immigration. In the research I did for my book, I could not find a case where any industrialist or any representative of a business group went before Congress or anyone else and asked that immigration be restricted. Who wants to restrict immigration is the labor unions.
Well, there was a curious thing which we reported on Alternative Views two or three weeks ago, and that is the fact that undocumented workers, if that's the correct term, actually formed the first labor union, or at least a labor contract with some agricultural interests in Arizona, which seems to me a rather bit of a contradiction. Here they're supposedly in the country illegally, and yet they're signing a legal contract with the growers. Is this something which you think might spread more, or is this perhaps an answer to some of the problems? They're horribly exploited and treated terribly.
I'm not sure there's an answer to those problems. As long as we're going to be deporting people, and I think that policy will continue. I really don't think there's an answer. I think that immigrant Mexicans are going to be the bottom end of the labor force in this country for the remainder of my lifetime, perhaps.
There was also a curious thing which we reported a week ago, and that is that in southern Mexico, undocumented workers from Guatemala are coming northward and working in, the coffee fields or some agriculture business there. And the Mexicans are complaining about that. It's a parallel situation to that which we have in the United States.
The Mexicans have quite a bit of undocumented immigration from Central America, especially El Salvador. And they behave exactly as our immigration service does, or perhaps with less finesse and politeness. So you're dealing with a hemispheric problem here. And when the Mexicans catch a Salvadorian in Mexico, many times they don't know if he intends to immigrate to Mexico or to the United States, because there's also undocumented immigration to the U.S. from Central America, and most of it comes through Mexico.
Now, you wrote some just fantastic articles in the Texas Monthly. I haven't had a chance to read your book yet, but those articles are so beautifully written and well-researched that your eyes just flow across the pages and you're not even aware you're reading. Just things pop alive in your head. But you actually spend a lot of time with these people and researching before you write these articles. And you have a great feel for it. What is it in your background that gives you this ability or gives you this feel?
I don't know that my editors would agree I have that ability.
Less to keep your wages low, right?
Perhaps. I don't know how to answer that question. I did the book on undocumented workers. I began it at a time when I was living in Dumas, Texas, and most of my friends were without papers. And I began to notice, gee, the panhandle of Texas is a part of Mexico practically, at least in the rural areas. And I became curious.
But you have such a feel, and they accept you. I mean, they let you into the innermost secrets of what's going on, as we'll talk about later when we get into your activities with the guerrillas.
Well, part of it is knowledge of Spanish and Mexican culture. Well, what were some of your experiences in researching, living with the undocumented workers? Could you get a real sense of their oppression? Is this really probably a super exploited subproletariat that is a somewhat unique historical phenomena?
I doubt that it's a unique historical phenomenon.
Well, currently in America, let us say.
In America at this point, not only Mexicans, but Haitians and a lot of other people are here without papers. And in fact, the Immigration Service was established not to keep Mexicans out of the United States, but to keep Chinese out. So I don't think there's much that's unique about their situation. I think that economically they are exploited in this country. On the other hand, most of them feel quite prosperous because coming here makes the difference between starving and not starving. And very few of them are bitter towards this government or its policies. Most of them think that being deported is a part of a game, and they take very little, they have very little political criticism of that.
So they don't really exhibit radical political consciousness in this little organization?
Not at all.
Or things like this. Do you think there's any parallel to the earlier waves of European immigration, that when immigrants came off the boat in Europe, it was a great experience just to get a job, to have even a minimal standard of living after incredible poverty and deprivation? Then this immigrant wave, one after the other, got integrated into the life of America. Do you see this happening with the undocumented workers? Do you see tendencies that they will simply be accepted as part of American life? I think Time magazine had a cover story of our largest minority, that Hispanics are now larger than blacks, actually, in terms of minority population in America. Do you think they'll just increasingly be accepted and integrated as earlier American immigrant waves were, or do you think that there's something special here because they're illegal?
No, there's something special, not because they're illegal, but because of where they come from. The word WAP, which is used for Italians, stands for without papers. Many of the Italian immigrants were illegal. But the difference is that the Chicano population will not be absorbed as the Italians are, because Italian immigration slowed. So did German, Irish, and every other form of immigration. Mexican immigration is not going to slow. So that we will never reach a point where these people are cut off from their homeland, where English is an easier language to use than Spanish in many cases. The Italians would still speak Italian had immigration continued steadily. It didn't. For them, for the Mexicans, it will. So I don't believe that this country will simply absorb them. I don't think this country knows what it's going to do. But if it begins to try to absorb them, there's all of Latin America down there, and much of it is starving, and I don't know when I could predict an end to that sort of immigration.
Well, this raises the question of what factors in Mexico are driving the immigrant workers up north to seek jobs. Phil, you've written on Mexico extensively in research. What are the factors in Mexico that are responsible for this migration northwards?
I guess you could say basically there's two things. One is how the Mexican Revolution developed, and the other is the whole role of the multinational corporations since World War II. And I'll show some slides now which we can use to illustrate this whole process and give a little bit of a feel for what Mexico's like and some of the things that have happened. Here we have an example of what happened during the Mexican Revolution of 1910 to 1917, you really have to go back and look at this period to get an idea of where Mexico is now. This is a burned-out sugar mill, which was destroyed by Zapata's rebels just south of Mexico City in the state of Morelos. Up until this period, there had been a dictatorship with extreme concentration of wealth and with most of the economy centered on rural agriculture. Zapata started the revolution in the south and completely broke the old system and led to a new government. But what happened was that there were faction fights between the different groups in the revolution, and the faction which finally came out on top was not Zapata, who was killed by the other revolutionaries, but another general named Carranza, who set up a government very much aimed at modern development and progress.
Do we have a next one? Okay. There we go.
And here you can see the churchyard where Zapata was elected as president of his village defense. And although Zapata and almost a million others died in the course of the revolution, we can see in Mexico that their efforts were largely in vain, simply because the peasant for whom the revolution was fought has, in most cases, not had his life improved very much. And here you can see, just as an example, the little town of Morelos, Anenicuilco, where Zapata was born and grew up. And this is very typical of so many rural towns in Mexico, that they have experienced very little development, very little improvement in their standard of living. And although the Mexican economy, if you look at the overall statistics, you will see that there's been incredible growth. What you find is that the growth in the rural area has been in the hands of a few rather prosperous growers, or to use a modern term, in the hands of agribusiness. And then in the cities, there's also been extreme growth, but concentrated in the hands of multinational investors. And this is another shot, again, in the hometown of Zapata, kind of symbolic of the fact that even though the revolution began here, so many of the rural peasantry has been left behind, and people exist at a very, very low level of income and low technology.
Are these people mostly Indians?
In this particular area, they were Indians in the last century. Mexico has a rather unique way of looking at Indians, that if you adopt modern ways of living, you're no longer considered an Indian. So the ancestors here were, in fact, Indians. And again, here you can see an ox cart, very typical scene in some parts of Mexico, and yet this coexists beside the very modern agribusiness, which looks almost exactly like agribusiness in Southern California, with your large irrigation and your modern tractors and the like.
Got the next slide.
And here you can see someone making adobe again. This is very typical of so many people in rural Mexico who, as Dick mentioned, the statistics on unemployment and employment are very imprecise, because you have someone like this who might work for a couple of days a week making adobe bricks, and his annual cash income might be $100 if he's lucky. And so you have so many marginal people like this, which is starting to give you an idea of where this tremendous flow of people coming up to the United States starts from. You have people in Mexico, in rural areas, that are either totally unemployed or living at a very, very low economic level. And so, especially as the population has increased, you now have more unemployed, landless peasants than you did at the time of the Mexican Revolution. These peasants begin to leave the countryside after spending generations there in extreme poverty. They leave the countryside sometimes after having continued to fight for their rights, and they come either to the cities or to the United States, as we have seen in so many cases.
Phil, do you have any figures on if there's an increase of people coming to the United States now, if there's more immigrant workers? Maybe Dick has some figures. Has there been an increase in this? Is there increased poverty now in Mexico, increased unemployment that's caused an increase in migration, or is there a sort of decrease? or leveling off?
There's really two big guessing games in Mexico. One is the percentage of unemployed Mexicans, and the other is how many people come to the United States. And so much of what we know about how many Mexicans come to the United States is how many agents the INS sends out in the field. And if they decide they want to arrest maids in El Paso, the statistics for unemployed Mexicans are coming to the United States goes up. And so we really know very, very little. Mm-hmm. And that's the constant theme of all the scholars who specialize in studying undocumented workers in this country, is that we really have very little idea how many come, and the statistics are pretty much based on who gets caught, and that's more of a political and an economic issue.
There's a point here I think that should be made to strengthen what Philip is saying. If an American tourist goes to Mexico, and especially to Mexico City, what he sees is an urban democracy and all of the luxuries of developed countries and so on. And they say, well, this is Mexico. You have to get away from the tourist centers to see rural Mexico, and even then you have to figure out how many people are in the cities and in the country. The government claims it's about 60-40, with the majority being urban. The government counts anyone who lives in a town of 2,500 or more as being an urban resident. Mm-hmm. A town of 2,500 or more would have maybe 700 adults. These are rural people. I don't know what a closer figure would be, but it's my estimate that it's probably 50-50 anyway. So when you talk about rural Mexico, it's not like talking about the rural United States. You're talking about half the country.
And you're also talking about incredible gaps between rich and poor and development and underdevelopment, which we'll probably get to later. Go ahead, Phil. Your slides.
This is just one example of what you see in rural Mexico, which is a very strong influence of city corporations, which bring in their wares and often have very, very little to do with improving the lives of the people living there. These calendars are advertising soft drinks and beer and present a model which is totally out of keeping with the life of the rural Mexican. I took this picture in an Indian village, and here you have a little blonde kid. Mm-hmm. And again, the multinational advertising and their products are just totally out of touch with the reality of existence in rural Mexico, and yet the multinationals have found that with that approach they can maximize their profits. And so not only do the people become poor, but they are taught to drink Coca-Cola because that's more sophisticated than drinking orange juice.
This is the model for advertising throughout Mexico, the Great White Hope, using these white gringo models, which seems ludicrous, but it's just trying to get them into consumerism through identification with gringo ideals. Curious.
Yeah, here you can see, as Dick will tell you in a few minutes, that there's a tremendous potential for violence in rural Mexico. There has been relatively little change simply because people are unorganized, and the Mexican government is extremely effective at first co-opting protest or secondly suppressing it. This is just one example where the town rebelled against the mayor. Mayors, as are all political officials in Mexico, are appointed, and then the vote is carried out by the people who vote for the appointed candidate. And in this particular little town in the state of Tlaxcala, the people rebelled and drove out their mayor, and yet they were completely unorganized, they were unarmed, and so if this type of protest ever continues, the Mexican government simply sends in the army, and that's the end of it. And as of yet, there has been no widespread rural opposition to the government, so they can deal with any opposition on a piecemeal basis. And rural protest quite often spills in to urban areas. And here you can see one example of peasants who come into Mexico protesting the many grievances. They have lack of land, they're poor, they don't have jobs, they've been lied to by the government literally for generations. The Mexican agrarian reform supposedly started in 1915, and each Mexican president who's come along has promised people land, and yet the land in many cases has stayed in the hands of big landowners. And so people protest generally rather ineffectively, but we'll see now some more protests from Dick, who has some pictures here. And
well, before we go into that, let's have a little background on this. This is a very fascinating story. Dick, could you tell us how you made contact with these revolutionary guerrillas in Mexico?
There has been now for, at least since about 1970, the left-wing movement in Mexico has been growing. It was practically closeted before then. And it has developed an armed wing. There are terrorists of 16 different stripes in Mexico. And there are a few organizations which I regard as more literate, which organize peasants to seize land and arm them. One of these organizations, which is now called the PPM, the Proletarian Party of Mexico, had a representative and a member and a founder in San Antonio, Mario Cantu, a restaurant owner there, who knew the people who formed the PPM before they had formed it. When they formed it, he joined. Mario was frequently implicated in gun-running affairs, and I went to him and said, look, I want to do a story about you and the guerrillas. It took about 6 months to win their confidence. He had to go to Mexico twice. He was on federal probation at the time and wasn't supposed to leave San Antonio.
He went to federal probation?
Oh, yes, he was. And,
for gun running? Or?
No, this time for a charge known as shielding illegal aliens. He had interfered with an immigration raid. But he went to Mexico and met with the guerrillas. Their leaders are all in hiding and are wanted, and set up for me to go down. Then I went down, and there were some snafus. But the first time, spent a while with them in August of 77. Mario and I went together in January of 78 and in October of 78. And his probation office subsequently tried to revoke his probation. And he fled to Europe. He's now living in Madrid, where he's agitating with some other Mexican exiles around the question of the relationship of the United States to Mexico.
Well, that's quite a story.
Then you actually went into the mountains with the...
No, three times I have been.
What were some of your experiences there?
Well, my general impression is this, that in rural Mexico, democracy has never existed. What you have there is a rule by force. The big landlords shoot anybody who gives them trouble. And the small peasants, if they lose their land or want more land, resort to arms to get it. Because the government is, practically speaking, absent. They petition for land. I've talked to people who are waiting 35 years for a land grant. So you've got an armed Wild West type society in some sections of those hills.
Where the peasants are actually seizing land with guns forcibly.
Yes.
Is that, where
yes.
are the, some of the regions where this has taken place?
Well, in the Sierra Juarez of Oaxaca, mm-hmm. and in Veracruz, there's been quite a bit in Michoacan. There's been some by other organizations practically anywhere in rural Mexico.
Mm-hmm. What was going on in the Sonora region, more in the north? There were some articles in Mother Jones about a movement of peasants there to expropriate land from absentee landlords.
This was at the end of the Echeverria term. Mm-hmm. And it's never been clear in my mind, Philip may know better than I do, whether or not, in fact, the PRI may have supported that.
Mm-hmm.
But that region is one in which there's a great deal of truck farming. They farm export crops and export them to the United States. Oddly enough, Mexico's importing beans and wheat and most other staples. But the peasants seized the land, and they declared that it was illegally owned because the tracts were too big, or bigger than what's allowed.
Well, there has been land reform in the past. Was this carried out, if at all, and what's the status of it now?
You get showcase land reform is what I've seen. Philip knows much more about what it's been statistically than I have.
Yeah, about 3 million people have actually received land somewhere along the line. The president that passed out by far the most land was Lázaro Cárdenas in the late 30s, who really made an honest effort at reform. Seeing the situation in Mexico as being politically explosive, he made a lot of far-reaching reforms, just like Franklin Delano Roosevelt did in this country at the same time. He broke up a lot of big estates, gave land to the peasants, but since then, the agrarian reform has become more and more of a political sham. Agribusiness has become richer and richer. And increasingly, the land that is given to the peasants and broadcast so widely as a measure of justice by the revolution is really land that is totally worthless, and yet they pass out millions and millions of acres of it, and that rings up very impressive statistics. But very noticeably lacking has been credit and technical aid and anything to make this land productive and to improve the lot of the people who do, in fact, receive it.
Well, Cardenas also took over the oil industry, nationalized it, did he not?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And now Mexico has its own Pemex national. How does this fit in with the multinational oil company framework and the OPEC situation?
Well, I'll backtrack a little bit. Mexico was the world's second largest producer of oil back in the early 20s and the world's largest exporter. It was sort of the Saudi Arabia of the world back then. But by the late 1930s, 1938 to be exact, when Cardenas nationalized the oil, production was down to 5% of what it had been, which is to say that the American and British oil companies there had pretty much pumped the fields dry that they knew about. Since then, and especially in the last couple of years, they have located tremendous new finds which are undoubtedly going to change the whole reality of Mexico and the reality of Mexican-U.S. relations. We simply don't know yet a lot of the basic answers which are going to tell us where things are going. Given the track record of the PRI, though, it doesn't bode very well for the vast majority of the Mexican population. Generally, development by the PRI has been very much oriented toward business interests and pretty much left the average worker out of the picture and not produced good conditions for living.
So, by the PRI, what do you mean?
The PRI is the Revolutionary Institutional Party, the basic party of the revolution.
Phil, I'm a bit puzzled. Granting what you said is correct about PRI being basically in the interests of the industrialists and landowners and not the workers, still, what will the government do with those vast profits that supposedly will be coming out of the oil fields? Do you think there'll be graft and corruption in the government? Do you think the investment will be for mainly big business and capital, or you think there'll be a spillover to genuine projects of social reform that might help the people in the country?
Mm-hmm. Undoubtedly there's going to be some spillover, and there'll be some people who didn't have jobs before who will in fact get jobs. But if you just look at the history of oil development in the 20th century, there's no country or region in the world that has used oil wealth to eliminate poverty and bring about social justice. And that, of course, goes for Texas, which has had tremendous oil development in the last generation, and yet you still have incredible poverty here. And since Mexico has one of the worst track records of any Latin American country as far as social justice, I don't think it's very realistic to think that they're really going to focus their oil income on resolving problems in Mexico. And in fact, the one Latin American country with a worse income distribution then Mexico is Venezuela, which has had a generation of oil wealth to try to solve problems, and it has simply not tried to not solve these problems.
Right now, Mexico has the largest debt to American, well, I call them American, I will say multinational or transnational banking interests, and the IMF and the World Bank, multinational corporations. How do you account for that, plus the fact that Mexico does have a strong oil industry? They're just not able to export enough to be able to retire these debts? Are they on the same track of debtorism that the rest of the third world is with the multinationals?
It's a matter of timing. As with the rest of the underdeveloped world, Mexico, since World War II, has suffered from balance of payments problems, and especially as they invited multinational corporations to come in during the 60s, they thought that would make them financially independent. But what in fact they found is that the multinationals end up sending a lot of profits out and charging for licensing, charging for various technical things. So in fact, you have the countries running into debt as they invite the foreign companies in, rather than the foreign companies coming in to help solve their economic problems. This process has been a continual one since the 60s up into the 70s, and is still going on now. They have trade deficits, and the multinationals take out more than they bring in.
Phil, do you think that this might generate a popular resistance movement, as in Iran, where you had a situation where there was tremendous wealth that simply wasn't being used in the people's interests? It was being exploited by a corrupt government and multinational foreign corporations. Do you think that the same sort of mobilization of the people could take place in Mexico, who would see that their wealth was being squandered, that they were being exploited by foreign domination corporations and a corrupt government, and that this could lead to popular upheavals? Is there any evidence that tendencies like this might develop in Mexico, given the oil wealth and what you predict will be the exploitative use of it that won't aid the people, basically?
Oh, I think there's no question but that there's the conditions there, although virtually everyone of any political persuasion who looks at the Mexican government comments on how effective it is at maintaining the status quo through a variety of political manipulation. But what's really important to note is that although we've read a lot about Mexican oil wealth, none of it has arrived in Mexico. Mexico was importing oil through 1974, and only thus about 3 years ago actually started exporting any oil at all. It's still spending much more on developing new wells and refineries and pipelines than it's taking in oil exports. So it'll probably be 1981 before the Mexican oil even starts to bring in money which can be used for any sort of social problem. And so now it's completely speculation where the oil money is going to go, because there in fact is no oil money right now. It's still a couple years down the road.
Phil, isn't the main beneficiaries of the Mexican social system the middle class, that when they have had social programs, that they've usually gone to the benefit of the middle class? I was told that they have a tremendous system of socialism for middle class bureaucrats, teachers, and such in the Mexican system. Is this correct? Do you think that they might also be the beneficiaries in the future? Has this been the trend in the past?
Yes, they're in fact, I guess every social system in the world benefits some people, and certainly there's a small, very wealthy elite on the top. But then there's about a sixth of the population which is middle class, and it's predominantly concentrated in Mexico City. And you can literally ride for 20 miles along the western side of Mexico City and think you're in Europe, because everybody has a car and a fairly nice house, and yet that represents an incredible concentration of wealth sucked out of the smaller towns and sucked out of the countryside to provide a decent standard of living for the Mexican middle class. But again, that has, you have to emphasize it. The middle class is perhaps only a sixth of the population, and the fact that they have a car and a nice house and a TV means that some worker in the countryside works perhaps to pick tomatoes, which are exported to the U.S. to generate a profit, and then he is paid perhaps only a couple hundred dollars a year.
Many of these middle class people are also government workers. They have a tremendous parasitical bureaucracy there that has sort of a social system, a welfare system, almost cradle-to-the-grave socialism. I was astounded when I was in Guanajuato one summer at the benefits these people had for health care, social security, unemployment insurance, et cetera. But it was a small group of people that were the beneficiaries. Dick, did you have a comment?
One of the points that might be mentioned about socialism for the middle class is that in Mexico, a lot of the peasants, especially in the south, produce handicraft items. This is a photo, incidentally, it's been stuck here, of a meeting of this of a revolutionary party in a peasant village in Mexico. As you can see in the photo, almost all the adult males turn up. Here's another one of a similar meeting. I had to black out the eyes on these people's on this photo so that these people could not be identified. While I'm here, I'll just hit the photo. Here is a peasant village of some 500 inhabitants, and this is a part of their armed force. It's been armed by a revolutionary group. If you will note, they're using M1 carbines and old Mausers. Here's another one in a smaller village, essentially the same weapons.
What chance do these people have against the army? I guess they would have a reasonable chance against the private armies of the landowners, maybe the local police, but the army might be too much for them.
The army in the most of these areas, the army is stationed in a city. It takes days to get out there. The problem I think they have in fighting the army is that of resolve. I think they could probably outgun the army because they have
guerrilla,
certain advantages,
guerrilla type
and certain tactics. But the problem is resolve. The people very often seize land with guns and they'll fight off the landlord's thugs. But when the army and the agrarian reform comes in, they say, well, gee, now they've got us. In the long run, they may be right. It may make best sense to surrender, but the pattern thus far has been one of conflict with the landlord's agents and then running from the army, in fact, surrendering land to the army once you've taken it.
Do you have any sense of how the army people feel about going in there and fighting with these guerrillas? In other words, it could be like in Iran that there could be a point where the army simply doesn't want to fight at the peasants because of the political consciousness of the army, or a simple fear that they're scared out there. Is there any evidence that this might take place, or do they have a pretty professional army there?
They don't have a very professional army. Most of it's drawn from peasants.
Mm-hmm.
But as soldiers, they're much better off than they would have been as peasants. They keep that in mind. The only tales I have heard of soldier mutiny, I've only heard one. It occurred when a soldier was told to invade his hometown, and his mother came running out the door, and she says, what are you doing here, you know, with this gun and so on? And so he refused, and two or three other soldiers went with him and refused. But that didn't stop the army from doing its mission. So I think it's far premature to a situation like you had in Iran.
Mm-hmm.
A minute ago you were talking about middle class socialism, and I wanted to bring up that these peasants make artifacts, blankets, hats, all sorts of things, and they're paid next to nothing for it by commercial operators who tend to soak tourists and the Mexican middle class. The prices they charge are fantastic. So the Mexican government, in the name of socialism, established in every Mexican city an agency to sell handicraft items, artifacts, at cheap prices. However, it did not abolish its commercial competitors. Therefore, at Mexican government expense, items are bought from peasants at no better price than they would be paid from the commercial operators, but are sold at a lower price than the commercial operators sell them at. Or in other words, the Mexican government is subsidizing the decorations the middle class hangs in its house, which are made by starving peasants. The peasants still starve, but the middle class can cheaply buy blankets like I have on my walls.
Isn't that one good insurance policy by most any dictatorship or oligarchy, to have a strong, loyal middle class and then repress the lower class?
I suppose it is.
It's called fascism, actually.
What are some of these other pictures that you have?
Well, these are largely pictures of the guerrilla movement. Here are, when I went there, quite frankly, on my first trip, I was scared to death. I expected I was going to run into some hot-headed students who were up there agitating the peasants and pulling all sorts of dangerous stunts. It turned out not to be true. The people in these pictures are peasants. One of these fellows has an old Remington. It's a Mexican Revolution vintage rifle. Here's another meeting of revolutionary peasants.
How widespread is this around the country, and what is the support from the general public?
Well, it's very hard for me to say how widespread it is, because I've only seen the states of Oaxaca and Veracruz. Anytime you read Mexican newspapers, you will read of peasants seizing land and being lynched or shot anywhere in Mexico. It happens every week. Public support is never sought. The peasants do this as their own affair. I've never heard of them seeking support. But in rural Mexico, I would say it's pretty frequent now. Pretty frequent.
What about in urban Mexico? Is any radical agitation there and activity going on?
Since 1970, there's been so much of it. The Mexican Workers' Party, the Mexican Communist Party are all much bigger and much more open. There are hundreds of independent groups. There are church groups that lean to the left. And there are your terrorists. There are groups in Mexico which are on a par with the Red Brigades in Italy. we hear less about them because the media in this country has a northeastern and European bias. The Red Brigades are much closer to New York than La Liga 23 de Septiembre. But they're still there. And every day in Mexico, there's a bombing or an attempted assassination, I suppose, practically every day.
It's interesting that the Pope went down to address the Mexican and South American clergy, which was moving increasingly toward the left and Marxism, because the clergy developed a Christian social conscience that was so shocked by the poverty and exploitation that it was moving towards a gospel of social justice. It was very close to Marxism, and the Pope was trying to squelch that theology of liberation movement. Phil, didn't you have some more slides and some information on the urban situation there?
Yes, in reference to the meeting in Puebla, the bishop's meeting, the Pope, in a sense, warned Latin American Catholics that they should be careful and not mix too much ideology up with their theology, because they might lose the theology. And a radical bishop responded to him that let he who is without ideology cast the first stone. And I think that's a very good introduction to some of the problems which certainly ideology has brought about in Latin America. And we're going to see in Mexico now some of the urban problems, which are, one should remember, are very closely tied to rural problems, because what in fact you have, not only people coming to the United States, but literally millions of Mexicans leaving the countryside and coming to the city. And so what they're doing is shifting unemployment from the countryside to the city. And now we'll have some slides. Here you can see a shot of a modern factory in Mexico, and not coincidentally, it's an American-owned factory. This happens to be Kodak, but you find the major manufacturing enterprises in Mexico are very, very strongly controlled by U.S. and other foreign corporations. These corporations bring in their labor-saving devices from the United States, and so provide very few jobs for the people who do, in fact, come to the city looking for work. Here you can see what is probably the most famous political site in modern Mexico, the Plaza of Three Cultures. And not only is there a rural protest in Mexico, but as many can remember, that before the 1968 Olympics in Mexico City, there was a very strong student movement which was having a peaceful meeting in this plaza here, which was simply gunned down by the Mexican army. And that was the only way the Mexican army found that they could suppress the movement. The movement had hundreds of thousands of people in it, students who were marching in the streets, always peacefully, and in one stroke they physically eliminated the student protest movement, and the Foreign Press Corps estimates that as many as 500 people were killed here. And the people who come into Mexico City and the other large cities end up in the classical situation for Latin America, the squatter settlement or the shanty town. And this is just one of them. This one I visited last year is a little bit unique in that it has had a history of radical political organization. Most of the people who come into the shanty towns are thankful they have any place at all to sleep, and so keep a very low profile.
Well, Mexico City is supposed to become the largest city in the world in a few years, something like 25 million.
Yes, of course, that says a lot about projections. Not only do they project it to be the largest city in the world by the year 2000, but they also project that the increasing pollution will render the air unbreathable by the year 2000. So it's hard to say which will win.
I've seen estimates where as many as 50,000 people a year die because of air pollution.
Oh, yes. Of course, there's a vicious cycle of malnutrition, poor housing, respiratory diseases, and air pollution, all of which result in a very high mortality rate, especially among children. And you find in Mexico City, the infant mortality rate among children is actually increasing. And some of the shanty towns, in fact, have what we might call here civic pride. They invest what little money they have and build better housing, and in fact, take on a veneer of the lower middle class in some areas. As the years go by, the shanty towns actually show improvement and people improve their lives. And just as in the rural areas, you see the same forces impinging even on the shanty towns, where people have extremely low levels of income. They spend an awful lot of it on the very familiar products like Coca-Cola, rather than buying nutritional food with what little money they have. And here is a mass meeting at one of the shanty towns. The shanty town organized itself and has very much changed the apathetic image that one has of the rural dweller. They have demonstrations and have taken part in a variety of political struggles, not only within their own community, but have allied with other groups within the city. And they have set up a breakfast program. You can see here children lined up to receive free breakfast, and in fact try to provide some of the services which neither the government nor private industry provide to the population. And you can see here that they bring a lot of their rural customs into the city with them, and here you can see an altar on the street with the flowers, very reminiscent of what you would find in a small Mexican village where these people came from originally.
Is there an organization, though, which provides this and also establishing perhaps some continuity from city to city, or is this just an ad hoc thing that the various neighborhoods do on their own?
This is just an ad hoc thing in one neighborhood. Again, in both rural and urban areas, the country suffers from broad-based organizations that are nationwide and can really mount effective support for social change. And here you see some of the people living there. Again, just as with the people who come to this country, most of the people living in these communities really feel they're upwardly mobile because they have come out of rural Mexico where they have so very, very little. And they've even set up a little market here, again, very reminiscent of the traditional markets in Mexican villages. And here you can see them building a new house using their own labor and using bricks produced right there in the community. Another shot of their market. And here are some of the banners put up there in the squatter settlement. They have received a lot of support, especially from student groups. You can see here some signs from local high schools and universities. And this, we were mentioning a little bit earlier, the middle class. This is some housing built by the Mexican government for the middle class. And in fact, the shantytown that we've just been seeing used to cover the area where these apartment buildings stand now. At 4 o'clock in the morning, the police came in, drove the dwellers out, and at 6 o'clock in the morning, the construction equipment rolled in, and they built some nice housing for the Mexican middle class.
In this particular housing project, there was a shootout between the 23rd of September, a terrorist group, and the Mexican police. So it goes to show the Mexican government builds something for the middle class. It has its own malcontents. And there's violence on both sides of that street, one from the squatters defending themselves and the other from the middle class terrorists.
And you can see here some banners put up at a pharmaceutical factory struck by the workers. Again, there's a strong workers' movement. Most of it is under control of the government, though. You do find some dissidents who call strikes on their own. Generally, strikes have to be okayed by the union bureaucracy. And so you do see a few independent strikes and trade union workers marching in the streets.
Could we go back and have a translation of that last one? Can you do it backwards? This one there in the center.
This says, for an education in the service of the children of workers and peasants. This simply refers to the fact the government spends millions and millions of dollars on education, especially higher education, and yet it's the children of the upper and middle class who get into the universities, and lacking any sort of affirmative action program, the poor people, both in rural and urban areas, rarely get into the university.
That doesn't need to be translated.
And these are some signs painted and displayed at the National University protesting some revolutionary themes. Again, this is a workers' demonstration in the streets of Mexico saying, stop austerity, expansion of the state sector of the economy.
That's curious, isn't it?
They're calling for ceasing of the expansion of the state.
No, they say stop austerity, period.
Okay.
Start expansion of the state sector.
The state sector.
Because we're
so
taking
far
exactly the opposite position in America.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're saying there's too much social welfare programs and we need to cut back and lean things up. Mm-hmm. And they're taking the opposite position.
And here you can see one of the signs that the established political party, the PRI, has painted all over the country, again containing very revolutionary rhetoric, but very little practical aid.
Ah, and there's an old friend.
Yes, and Mexico has come under extremely strong influence of multinational banks, such as the Citibank here, which is building a new 18-story skyscraper in downtown Mexico City to manage its affairs. And not surprisingly, given the results in both urban and rural Mexico, we have lots of workers coming across the Rio Grande, which you can see here, and a few stop along the way at the various border industries, which were set up in 1965 to try to sop up some of the unemployment when the Bracero program ended. But even though they employ about 90,000 people today, they are only a drop in the bucket for the millions and millions of unemployed Mexicans. And that's the end of the slides.
And we're back where we started.
Right.
Do you have any comments on the recent Carter trip to Mexico, Phil? It seems curious that previously always the Mexican president came to America or they met in a border town for 2 minutes. But here Carter went as a suppliant, practically begging Portillo, who acted at times very haughtily with him. Do you think this indicates new American-Mexican relationships and power shifts because of the oil reserves in Mexico and America's desire for it?
Oh, I think definitely. Mexico is sort of like the proverbial beautiful woman now with a string of suitors. Not only are American presidents courting Mexico, but the French and the Japanese, and you see an extreme shift in Mexican-American relations, which I think will exist at least for the rest of the century.
So in the mass media in America might even have some actual clippings on Mexico once in a while. Well, we want to thank our guests, Dick Rivas and Philip Russell, for this superb covering of all aspects of Mexican life, history, for a very exciting in-depth focus on Mexico. Frank, you have a bedtime story for us?
Yes, it's actually the last paragraph of the article in Texas Monthly, which Dick wrote, and it gives a feeling for the real character of the movement going on in Mexico right now. The real character was described long ago by a now-forgotten general in Pancho Villa's army. The general told an American correspondent, "I'm not an educated man, but I know that to fight is the last thing for any people. Only when things get too bad to stand, huh? And if we're going to kill our brothers, something fine must come out of it." And it's that simple faith, something fine must come out of it, which keeps revolution alive in Mexico.
Viva.
Good night.
Good night.